Okay, so my name's Professor Richard Walton. I'm a lecturer in inorganic chemistry in the Department of Chemistry at the University of Warwick, and this week we're hosting the International Conference on Materials Chemistry, which is organised by the Royal Society of Chemistry, and it's a great pleasure to have Professor Sir Harry Kroto as one of the guest lecturers. Harry Kroto was awarded a Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1996 for his work on new forms of carbon. So I thought I'd start by asking Sir Harry about his background and how he got into studying chemistry in the first place.
Well, my father was a refugee, so he decided that the best way of getting a job was to make sure my maths and physics and science was good, so that's what I did at school. My main interest was art and graphics and other things, but I did well enough, and that's what I did at university. I did chemistry and then went on to do a PhD, and was interested in molecular spectroscopy, and then I thought it would be a good idea to do a postdoc and went to Canada to do a postdoc, and then I went to the States for a year for a postdoc, and then I was asked to come back to the University of Sussex to do molecular spectroscopy as a postdoc, and then was suddenly offered a lectureship, and I thought, well, I'll try for 5 years. It doesn't work. I'll go out to night school and get a proper job doing graphics, which is probably what I always wanted to do. But it went reasonably well, and that's how I ended up as an academic. I didn't have any great ambition to be a scientist. It was just following a path of least resistance. That's how we ended up here.
So in your career, which has taken you to lots of different places over a period of time, how do you see the role of chemistry, and has it changed in that time? Is it more important than it was?
I think it probably is somewhat more important. I think if we look at sustainability and survival issues, I think chemistry, chemical engineering, all aspects of material science will be even more important in the next few decades than it has been in the past. And it certainly won't diminish. And if you look at things like water purification, saving materials, recycling, solar energy conversion and things of this nature, there's no doubt in my mind it's as vital, if not more so, than in the past.
Okay. So what advice would you give to a young student who's thinking about their university options and how you can persuade them of the importance of chemistry? I mean, you've given some good examples there, but it's...
Well, I mean, I think it's more important that when a student goes to university, they do something that turns them on. I don't think... And if they turn on by chemistry, then that's obviously has some major sort of contributions to make to society. And I think that's what I would angle on. I mean, I wouldn't think it's a good idea to turn people on to chemistry if it's not that something that they're likely to be passionate about. I think my feeling is they should do something that they are so keen on that they give it 100% effort. And if that's chemistry, then that's good. And that has a lot of great contributions to make. It has done in the past, such as penicillin, anesthetics, DNA, fingerprinting, and things of this nature. So they can certainly be sure if that's what they want, it will be a benefit to society, as long as it's in the right hands, of course.
Of course, yes. So thinking about your own research and the discovery of new forms of carbon, can you say something a little of the relevance and the importance of that work?
Well, I mean, carbon obviously is 95% of all chemistry. In organic chemistry, it's the fundamental chemistry of biology. And, of course, we have it in the petrochemical industry, so it's just all around us. In our case, we discovered the third form, and it was a really more of a fundamental breakthrough than anything else. And certainly, I don't think at the moment there are any industrial applications, although it looks very exciting possibility that it will be a key component in plastic electronics. But I think the main reason that it's captured the imagination is really twofold. One is it's rather pretty and beautiful, and everybody likes that, and human beings seem to be attracted to symmetric objects as they use them, paint them throughout any society. But the most important aspect as far as chemistry is concerned is that it told us something we didn't know about self-assembly. I mean, there were half a dozen papers claiming that we were wrong and it couldn't happen. And it does happen, and that indicates that we didn't understand some very important aspects of bottom-up assembly of materials. And the reason it's become something of an icon for nanotechnology is not that it necessarily is important application in nanotechnology. It's more that it told us that in bottom-up assembly, some very unusual structures could form which were unexpected. And this was so symmetric, if you took sort of standard thermodynamic arguments from macroscopic systems, you would say this couldn't happen because it's far too symmetric, entropy is against it. But in fact, in self-assembly, if you follow the path of energetics and dynamic processes, then this is the only thing that can form as you create these. So it's more to do with the fundamental science of what nanotechnology is, and nanotechnology itself is not fully understood. It has many sort of definitions, and for me, the most useful one, not the only one, is atom-by-atom molecule assembly of a complex system. And if you take that route, then the most complex system created by nanotechnology is a human being, or probably the human brain. So it tells you what is possible, that you know anything's possible if you follow that path. If you look at this and you very carefully, then you say, if I give you 60 carbon atoms and you jiggle them down, what structure will they have? They will have the pattern of a soccer ball with 12 pentagons and 20 hexagons. And that is a charismatic structure which Leonardo da Vinci, Piero della Francesca, and many others were fascinated with. And of course, it's the soccer ball structure of the from the Mexico World Cup. And that, as I say, was unexpected. And so it was a fundamental breakthrough, opening up our eyes to what can happen if you really decide to put a lot of effort into nanoscience and nanotechnology.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you've highlighted quite nicely that fundamental research is very important, and its relevance might not be spotted immediately, but it can lead to new areas of research, which then might develop into
Inevitably do. I mean, I think this is the big problem, especially as money gets tight, people in positions of responsibility and who don't understand how science progresses think that they can steer the funding into, efficiently into areas of fundamental applications or applications of benefit to the economy, and it can't be done. But you can say that till you're blue in the face to people, they still doesn't make any difference. And that argument's been going on for 100 years,
yes,
maybe not longer.
Right.
And it's falling on the ears of people who are totally deaf because they don't do science. I mean, only 1 or 2% of human race are scientists. By that I mean that they actually do science for research for a living. It's not a scientist is not someone who's got a training in science, or it's someone who day in day out wrestles with the universe and tries to extract the secrets. And that's a tough job, and only people who do it really appreciate it. Just as people who really perform music really understand the intricacies of playing a guitar. I mean, we can understand if we listen to it, but how it's done, and they see far more in the music than people who don't read music or don't create music. It's the creative process which is a problem, and people in government and in this country particularly seem to have gone down a very bad track at the moment.
I'd like to ask about your work outside of chemistry research per se. I believe that you have some charitable foundations. Perhaps you can say a little about this work.
Well, about the time of the Nobel Prize, I started to make programmes for television. BBC Two had an open access slot, and we managed to get, on average, between 7% and 12% of that viewing public around 12 midnight, because there were a lot of people. That's not available to us anymore. But anyway, I started recording scientists' lectures at the Royal Society and the Royal Institution. And I started those, and they were broadcast on television. But as you well know, the internet came along, and that's revolutionized the access to educational material and material of all kinds, audiovisual material. And I set up the Vega Science Trust to make the television programs, and gradually we created a cache of maybe 300 programs. Cost a lot of money. I put a little bit of, well, not a large amount of my Nobel Prize in it, but I started off with that and was able to raise on average about $1 million to $2 million, double my money. So we probably was worth about £3 million worth of recording. In those days, it was very expensive because the cameras were £50,000 cameras, and we had three or four of these. Today, it's just 10 times cheaper and infinitely cheaper. It was no longer able to pull in the money that was required for the Vega operation, and that's being transferred this year to an archive. So it was a fantastic archive of scientific material, and I'm very proud of what we were able to do with the Vega Foundation. But now I've set up something else called GEOSET, Global Educational Outreach for Science, Engineering and Technology, and I'm downloading the effort to organizations and particularly institutions like universities who will set up their own archive, which is on the web, and we gateway through the geoset.info site, which is in Sheffield University, to Florida State, where my own is, to Sheffield University, to Brighton University, to Sussex University, to Croatia, to Brazil, to other caches, some on YouTube from Harvard, some from other universities, some from schools. And three schools are just buying into it in the UK, but schools also in Japan and also in the States are buying into. And what they're doing is they're recording their students. Mm-hmm. And we're recording our undergraduates and our research students and our postdocs and our teachers. And the aim was to create a cache of all the smart teaching sort of modules that we can record from teachers. So a teacher has a great idea to present a particular specific topic. Okay, for instance, I introduce 7 and 8 year olds to algebra. It's only 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. Okay, I just take a box. How many faces on a box? 6. Okay, how many corners on a box? 8. How many edges on a box? 12. And then I introduce the 6 and 7 year olds to F corresponds to a face, right? E, an edge. C, a corner. So that's half of algebra. The other half of algebra is an equation. Faces plus corners minus edges. What does that? They put it in, they get the number 2. And that's the equation. And they're putting the numbers in there. That's all there is to the fundamentals of algebra. And 6 and 7 year olds can understand it. And I do that as a 2-minute presentation of the way teachers in the future can record their smart ideas. But we're also recording undergraduates. And this has been fantastic because we've actually now revolutionized the resume. Because as well as sending a pile of paper which no one's going to read, we send a URL of the recording of a presentation by, say, a graduate student, which is just a repackaged recording of the presentations they've already given. And what's happening is that people are clicking into the URL and then saying, wow, this is interesting or not, and then looking at the resume. And our students who do this are getting scholarships, jobs, lectureships, postdocs, and you name it. And I've just been at Lindau, where is the Nobel conference, and I spoke to several students, and the way they got to Linda and they were picked out was because they sent the URLs of their recordings either through our GSET program or through YouTube or things. And you can then think, well, this is much easier. Instead of why waiting through a pile of paper for you to do all this work, you just have to click into a URL, sit back, have a glass of wine, and you're on the way. Contact us and we can show you a very effective way of doing this, which is basically going to be the way it's going to happen. You are not going to shortlist, say, people for lectureships unless you've seen them already, especially if they have to come from another country. And we have ample evidence of that. This is cross-continent. You know, an Indian student in our Japanese node, one of Toyo University, is also one of our participating nodes in GeoSed. Postdoc working there sent the URL of the presentation to India, and she's now back in India as a lecturer at the Mahatma Gandhi University.
Okay, it's a very effective way of...
It's inevitable. It's going to happen. We're just getting it started.
Well, thank you very much, Sir Harry, for your time this morning, and I hope you enjoy your visit to Warwick and the Materials Chemistry Conference.
Thank you.